Sean Hughes on FUBAR Radio.
Well, hello there. I'm Sean Hughes, and you're listening to FUBAR Radio, as the jingle just told you, rather rudely. Listen, we've got a great show coming up, but let's have a little track first before any of this nonsense happens. And I'm going to press a button, I think. Bit of a mistake there. It's called FUBAR, which is kind of supposed to say fun, and I just played a very depressing song there by King Creosote. Well, it's, you know, it's sad, as in love can be sad. But anyway, enough of that. Here's FUBAR. I'm Sean Hughes. Our first guest in is the wonderful Phil Nichol, and we'll have lots of other stuff happening. You can tweet us if you're that way inclined at FUBAR Radio, and my good self, I think Sean Hughes, if you look that up. Email or text via the app, and I'm going to play one more track, and then we're going to listen to a veteran of... Actually, I'll ask you straight away, Phil, before I do that song. Do you like being called a veteran?
I am a veteran, yeah.
Because I get that all the time.
Yeah, I see it as a good thing. There was a little thing on Facebook last week about a veteran of 10 years. I thought, you're not a veteran at 10 years. You're brand new. You're new.
But I used to do a joke about it on stage about being called a veteran. So I didn't fight in any war. Because realistically, that's what veterans are.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Well,
Have you fought in a war?
No, but I had this old man. I got up to give an old man a seat on the subway once, and he wouldn't sit down because he said, if I sit down, I can't get back up again. And then he announced to me, you know how old I am? And then he announced, I'm 85 years old. I was all right. I fought in the war. He said, I couldn't get into the army, so I joined when I was old enough, and I was put in a tank. I was in the D-Day landings, and all five members of our tank survived D-Day. One of four tanks that made it. And then at the end of it, the whole thing, he goes and sees the guys every day, and he's outlived his wife. And he goes, what do you do for a living? I said, I'm a comedian. He went, well, that must be a difficult job.
Are you saying by proxy now you were in the war because you met that guy on the bus?
Yeah, I'd offer him my seat and he wouldn't take it.
Well, listen, we're going to have a proper chat, but let's play another tune and then we'll relax into it. This is Spain, Only One. Another really up-tempo one from my personal collection. There's a beautiful, beautiful Spain there, after the country. Only one. Now, I'm so delighted. My first guest in the new show at FUBAR is Phil Nichol. Phil.
Oh, hey, Sean.
So, now, you've been a musical comic for a long time, but you're bringing out your first album ever.
Yeah. Well, my first solo album. I recorded three albums and a cassette with Corky and the Juice Pigs.
We'll get to that.
Lesser known.
Let's just talk about...
Let's talk about me.
Yeah, let's talk about you.
Yeah, okay.
But 18 years it's taken to get this first solo one.
Yeah, it's taken me 18 years, and...
No, but that's what I mean. Like, why so long?
One track a year. And I just never got around to it. I mean, I had little bits and pieces of recordings, and I thought of putting them together into something, and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to put a band together and... put it out as a project.
So have you done it on your own label?
Yeah, it's me. It's me. It's Phil Nichol. I did everything.
That's the best way to do things,
yeah.
Though, isn't it?
Yeah. I had a great band, and we got together. My next-door neighbor, the day he moved in, he'd locked himself out of his house, so I helped him break into his house. Turns out his name is Rich Cawson, and he plays a Hammond organ for Tom Jones on tour and has a little studio in Wood Green that he runs and does like little recording stuff. And so he gave me mates rates, and we did it over like three, four days.
What were mates rates? Give me facts.
Back rubs. Thomas.
Is there any cash involved at all?
Sure. Well, you want to record an album?
But is this available in the shops or is it just at live gigs?
It's available on digital download only because I'm hip with the kids and I don't.
Loving your work.
Yeah, no packaging because the oceans are dying, my friend.
Well, I love the oceans, but I like packaging as well. Okay. Just don't put the packaging into the ocean. Well, that's my tip.
Well, here's what I've done because on Bandcamp, you can upload in the zip file the artwork so it can be folded together. So if you want packaging, you can make your own from, you can download it.
And once you said zip code, I was lost in
zip,
that hole.
Zip file.
Right. So, what made you want to bring it out after all that time though? Because when I say music comic, you're not really, you're a comic who sometimes does tunes.
Well, I moved away from doing that. I was in the band for so long and I played the guitar, so I was the musical comedy guy and I kind of moved away from it. In fact, the last three Edinburghs, there hasn't been any music in the shows that I've done at all.
Well, that's why you're well known for always doing a gifted one-man show each year in Edinburgh. What happened last year? You did a storytelling thing.
Last year I did I was attempting to do something a bit more heartfelt. I've been doing storytelling for years, like since 1998, as a style of stand-up. And it's kind of become de rigueur. It's what people do now. They tell stories. But I had this really good story called The Weary Land, and I was actually trying to pitch it to BBC Radio, to be a... David Sedaris type,
right.
Not in his style, but the formula of telling a long story that has, it's intricate and has like a heart on something sort of more valuable behind
and
it.
And Radio 4 said, will there be sound effects? Yeah, there'll be and horses and
there
stuff?
There is. There'll be the sound of an alarm.
And so is that happening then or no?
It went really well. I'm just working on it now and we'll
no,
see.
But no, for the Radio 4.
Yeah, well, I'm just working on it now.
You're working with another.
Yeah, working with
another. So you started off like, everyone assumes you're Canadian, but you're one of those Scottish, fellas.
Yeah, I was born in Scotland.
Yeah. Whereabouts?
In a place called Cumbernauld.
That doesn't even exist.
It does.
That's Canadian version
of Scotland. No, Cumbernauld. It exists. It's just a new town just outside Glasgow.
Right.
In fact, in the 1970s, they were trying to get all of the people out of the slums in Glasgow out into the countryside because that's where you want Neds. And they had this advertising campaign on the television. What's it called? Cumbernauld. And my dad went, well, that's good enough for me. And he's like,
so are both your parents Scottish then?
They are.
And so then why did they move to Canada? Was it illegal stuff that you can't talk about?
No, I can tell you. My dad was, my dad's a devout born again Christian.
You should see Phil's face changing there, really precious.
Not really precious.
How dare you,
How
Sean?
Dare you? My dad has never committed a crime that I know of. No, he was a builder. My dad was a cabinet maker by trade. And Canada was the land of milk and honey. And believe it or not, you used to be able to get, £4 to the Canadian dollar. And back in the day, that was only like 19.
But what was it, purely for just employment then? Yeah.
Yeah, he'd gone there as a younger man with his brother, and then his brother had stayed there.
Saw all that milk and honey and thought, I'm coming back.
Yeah, I'm going back to that. So he came back, met my mum, had three kids, and then they took us all there.
So, but that's like, weirdly, I was moved when I was four as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that's one of? Do you feel like a bit? You've always been a bit of an outsider because you're always having to just try to fit into places.
Desperate to fit in. I moved to Canada, then we moved back to Scotland after 10 months because my mum and dad didn't like it because my mum missed all her friends. And we moved back to Canada because my father was offered a better job and a grant from the Canadian government to bring him back. And then we were between age 9 and 13, I moved 8 times, went to five different schools. And then I went to university for acting school. I went for 4 years, did a touring company and dance company, and then left acting school and went on the road. I've never been in one place for one time. This is the longest I've been in a room.
Well, yeah, I appreciate you. You better go.
I know, I'm going. I'm nervous.
But so, like, did you always find it, like, so you found it hard to make friends then all the time?
Yeah, I'm like, have you seen the movie Zelig?
Yeah.
Woody Allen, topical. Yeah. Woody Allen, Zelig. But he tries to fit in, the Zelig character. He tries to fit in wherever he becomes the people he's with. I'm a bit like that, and I've been accused of actually being shallow. But by the end of this interview, I'll probably be talking to some
who accused you of being shallow?
Ridiculous Irish accent. Jesus.
But you haven't even got a, like, but do you consider yourself Scottish or Canadian?
I'm Scottish Canadian. I'm Canadian.
Don't say Scottish Canadian, because there's no such phrase.
Well, there is, in Canada there is. No, because Canada's more the cultural mosaic as opposed to the American cultural melting pot. You know the difference, right?
The
melting pot, you have to become an American. Whereas in Canada, you become a Scottish Canadian or a Jamaican Canadian.
Yeah, but you wouldn't go around, like, introduce yourself, like, hi, I'm a Scottish Canadian. You just go, hi.
Yeah, well, I could do.
I'm not saying you couldn't, but you know what I'm saying. It's just you wouldn't. Everyone doesn't go around saying everywhere where they're from.
No, they don't.
Because Canada gets a bad rub, so that would really not help the tourist place.
Canada is probably one of the most popular nations to come from in the world. When you say
who told you that?
Everyone does. When you say, where are you from? They go Canada. They go, oh, I love Canada. I've got a cousin there, and I know someone from Canada. Oh, I've been to Canada, but they love Canada. People love Canada.
I'm not coming across the same statistics as you.
No, really.
And I'm not down on Canada.
Where are you getting your statistics?
I'm not giving you any. You said everybody.
Everybody.
But where are your family now then?
They're in Canada. They're in a place called Pickering, which is a new town just outside Toronto.
So it's always the new towns as
I know.
Well.
So wow. Actually, my dad tried to move us up in the world, so he moved us to a home of the world's largest nuclear plant. Pickering.
Lovely yes, word. No
effect on me whatsoever.
Do you think you'll move back there one day? Like if you were settling down? I don't think you're the
to
settler.
Pickering, to home of the world's largest nuclear plant.
Well, in Canada.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I'm going to get a job there. And I'll open up the nuclear comedy club.
Why not? It'd be great.
The laughs have the half-life.
So, like, you're one of those, you do all the Melbourne and all those.
I have done, yeah. I've done Melbourne about 10 times. I was married to an Australian woman because that's, you have to do that. It's part of the festival.
That never happened when I was there, but I seem to be missing out on a lot of these things that apparently are de rigueur. But we won't talk about that breakup then because you smooth it over that.
Yeah, no,
I take there's a couple of songs on the record about that.
Oh, yeah, there are, yeah. There's one called The Bitter Song.
And so the Australian girl?
It was the Australian girl. We're friends now, and she won't, I mean, she might hear this, but she actually left me, this is perfectly true, because she can't write this stuff. She left me, and the guy she left me for, his name was Flight.
Right. Was,
and guess what he did? He took off on her. It was great. Anyway, that's true.
But,
yeah. This isn't routine, by the way. I've never said that before.
What I'm still thinking about is, can you truly be friends with someone who you were married with and you're not?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
Phil, come on, let's think.
Well, we're still friends.
Yeah, but we were never married, like, you know?
No, I know, but we can be now.
All right, well, but you're over now, though, yeah?
Well, The Weary Land, the show I wrote this year, was actually about the reconciliation, the moment of reconciliation between me and my wife 7 years acrimonious...
Phil, just say you're over it because it's going to be a link for the next song. Play with me. Let me ask you again. But Phil, like, you know, obviously it's heartbreaking when a relationship breaks up, but I take it you're over it now.
Well, she's always on my mind.
Well, let's see.
Maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should have. Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I could have. Little things I should have said and done, I just never took the time. You were always on my mind. I never told you. I'm so happy that you're mine. If I made you feel second best, girl, I'm so sorry I was blind. You were always on my mind. You were always on my mind. Tell me, tell me that your sweet love hasn't died. Chance to keep you satisfied. Little things I should have said and done, I just never took the time.
Simon from Leeds, just got that email, Simon. He's loving the chilled out tunes, Sean. Spelt Sean right, loving that man. Oh. Phil Nicholson, actually later on as well, we're going to be playing one of your songs in a sec. Ooh. But we've got the singer Chris TT. Have you heard of him?
No, I haven't.
Well, you're going to. Oh, everyone's going to hear about him right soon. On. Yeah. He's, well, hopefully he'll be here. He's on a train and he's been texting. I think he's stuck in the toilet or something.
He's related to Mr. T at all?
Everybody is. Yeah. If we're looking at the whole religious aspect of Adam and Eve,
sure.
You know, we all came from that.
Yeah, sure.
So, are you a religious person, Phil Nicol?
I believe in you.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I was raised. My father was a devout, born again Christian in the Brethren faith. I went to church five times a week till I was 14. And then I discovered...
That's because you had no friends, because you were moving to school all the time.
Exactly. Well, that's the only friends I had, were part of the Christian youth group.
Oh.
And then I discovered The Clash. So that was the end of that. It's kind of
what were they doing a gig at the Methodist Church?
No, or? I realized I wasn't allowed to listen to any secular music. And I was part of a Christian surf punk band.
So what, did The Clash pretty much save your life then?
Yeah, pretty much.
Are they one of your, would they be one of your top...
Joe Strummer is, I can't, I love his voice.
I had the privilege to meet him once.
Did
and,
you?
Weirdly, it was at a World Music Awards, and he came up to me, and it's always really chuffed when someone comes up to you.
Yeah.
He says, thanks for all the laughs over the years. And then he goes, I says, what are you doing here? He says, I don't know, world music, fucking rubbish. And then he was introducing an award, and he goes, world music is fantastic! Joe, you liar!
They're probably all doing that. Him and Peter Gabriel are back, having a spliff, going, oh, these idiots.
I know, but it's just like, it's weird when things like that happen.
Drum, rhythm, spangle.
But you do, like, when you're talking about your storytelling as well and your versatility in music, but you're actually, you set up your own theatre company as well.
Yeah, so I've run a thing called the Comedians Theatre Company with Maggie Inchley, who I met, doing a course.
You meet a lot of people, don't you?
I meet a lot of people. I'm a very open-minded, a very open, friendly kind of guy. Yeah.
That's just, when people say that, I just, do you know what comes into my head? Gangbangs.
Yeah, gangbangs, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to one now if you want.
No.
Put another track on.
I like the idea of it. Well, you can put on the, quickest track ever.
See if Simon from Leeds wants to get on a train and hop down here.
But so is the acting quite, I don't want to pigeonhole anyone, but is it just you want to do everything, or is there one particular thing that you think, this is what I'd like to see myself as?
I started off, I mean, it's really tedious and a bit dull, but I started off...
Don't do that story, then.
I started off back in 1972. No, I studied acting and trained as an actor. And
in
then,
Canada?
Yeah.
So does that count as...
The School of Dramatic Art. Yes, the great actors, William Shatner.
Look at you. You take such offense, man.
I know, I'm not getting offended, but it's Canada.
No, but just...
It's my people.
Your lovely face. Every time you can't obviously see it on radio, but
John
your
Candy.
Eyes change. but so, yeah, I didn't know you studied acting.
I studied acting. So I kind of... You know, fell into comedy, pursued that. And then when I became a solo actor and the Cork and the Juice Pigs broke up, I thought I'd try and pursue acting, which I did. And I was in 12 Angry Men with Owen O'Neill, and then we did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And then I formed my own company and started putting on my own productions that have done really well.
And so what's happening in Edinburgh this year? Are you going up?
I'm going up to do, I'm doing a monologue by Dave Flores. In 2011, he won the Fringe First Award for some weird monologue he did about a guy who was body locked. And
So this is an acting job?
Yes, an acting job, right. Yeah.
And then are you doing your own show as well?
Well, I hope to be performing from my album Late Night Electric Watermelon, which is an album I've got coming out on the 24th of February. I'm doing that as a live show with a full band, full orchestra.
Oh, brilliant. What full orchestra?
Well, there'll be, well, it depends how many people I can afford to pay, but I'm playing a 100-seater.
That just fits in the orchestra, sure.
I know, exactly. I'll be spending most of my money feeding a band, but there'll be about a band of 10, probably.
So, and what kind of, besides the obvious instruments, what ones are coming on?
Well, on the album, I don't know if we'll
get... On the live.
On the live, there'll be a horn section, full horn section, a pedal steel guitar, numerous bass, stand-up double bass, guitars.
Sounding jazzy.
Pretty jazzy. There's a couple of jazz tracks on there. There's a Billie Holiday, I do a Billie Holiday impression, and she sings a song that she wrote in 1942 as part of the American War effort called Fuck the Germans. That's
are you serious?
Jazz. Yeah, you want to hear it?
Yes, certainly do.
Let's put it on. Let's get that one on.
Well, we'll try.
Okay.
But she didn't write the song. Or did she?
No, I wrote the song.
Yeah, but you said I
introduced her as Billie.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
My name is Miss Billie Holiday, and tonight I want to sing a song that I wrote.
I was believing that she'd actually brought out a song called Fuck the Germans. Well, it was a B-side.
I want people to think it's her, definitely.
But so what's the album's coming? Is the title got any meaning or?
It's the state of mind I want you to be in when you listen to it.
We'll say the title again.
Late Night Electric Watermelon.
But that's too confusing to even contemplate.
Exactly.
So you just want it messy.
Yeah, just be in a watermelon state.
And
we kind of had an in-joke between me and my friends and a partner of mine that when you're so out of it, you can't quite speak, you just look over each other and go, watermelon.
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well,
that's never happened
to
me. There's lots of things.
Well, now you know.
So
there's lots of things that haven't happened to you. Unbelievable. Yeah. It's hard to believe, isn't it?
But you are.
There are so many things that haven't happened to you.
But
have you swum with dolphins?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Bad one. Okay.
But I'm not very good.
Climb the Eiffel Tower on the outside? No, you haven't. Someone has.
Wait, you haven't though, have you?
No.
Right.
Okay. I was going to say yes, but then you questioned me about it. You realize but, quickly.
Yeah, but so, like, because you're quite free living in that sense. You like to take your substances.
Substances, yeah.
I'm trying to be subtle here.
Yeah, no, be subtle.
What's your substance of choice?
My substance of choice, right now, coffee. I'm on a diet of coffee and raw meat.
And what about hardline drugs?
No, I've given all that up.
Have you actually just given up? Because I think people get to a certain age and just go.
I'm just out of time. I can't. You can't continue like that. I'm rock and roll, though.
You are very much
rock and
roll.
How about you? What's your.
I kind of...
Do you like a biscuit?
I used to like biscuits, but I just don't really like anything anymore.
So crushing them up, just doing it all.
I like the crushing up bit, because you are...
I think our lifestyle lends itself to being out, because by playing comedy clubs all the time. So over this weekend, I would have been out drinking after the show, socializing with the other comedians and with some of the punters and the staff of the Glee Club in Birmingham, and had a wonderful time. I think it's just part of the social... It's part of the socialization.
But so what,
social,
you'll get there.
This is a social thing.
But that's the thing. So do you think, in a sense, that comedy is a bit of a young man's game now? No, just purely from that, like, being out late.
In fact, all the young guys are actually, most of them are all teetotal. There's a huge movement in comedy to be teetotal and be hardworking and be... I mean, it used to be you could go up to Edinburgh and you get there and decide what you do when you went up there. Because I saw you do a show with Owen O'Neill years ago, and you didn't figure it out until you got there. I think by the end of the run, you were just starting to remember each other's names on stage. So, yes.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Owen's... So now you've got to be. Now people want to know February. It's Edinburgh's in August. People want to know now what you're doing, what the title is. Some people are doing previews in November for the following August, and they're determined and driven and young and healthy and with a joie de vivre that I don't have anymore.
But do you like these people?
Yeah, they're nice.
Okay, so we're going to play...
Of course I do, I'm Canadian.
Yes.
And we like, we like everybody.
Simon from Leeds is still loving the Chill That Tunes. Thanks for the email, still up there, lads. So Clowns Nose we're going to play. So do you want to tell us anything about this?
Clowns Nose, I wrote this at the end of a show I wrote called Nearly Gay, which was I was accused on stage by an American San Franciscan comedian called Scott Capurro. I was accused whilst I was on stage at the Gilded Balloon singing a song called I'm the Only Gay Eskimo with a group of 20 other comedians. He came on stage, grabbed the mic off me, accused me of being homophobic, threw the mic at me, and then stormed away off stage. So I wrote, I was genuinely hurt by that, and also he knew me.
The microphone or the actual words?
Yeah, they have both.
Words.
Both, the words. Oh. Yeah, words they hurt. So I wrote a show years later. I wrote a show called Nearly Gay, which was an answer to sort of like how incredibly ridiculous the accusation was, but how it changed the way that I approached my relationships with my gay friends and gay people in my social life.
Could you not have just sent him an email?
Yeah, I could have. He wouldn't speak to me.
But do you talk now?
Yeah, you're friends now. Yeah, I just sent him a lovely congratulations. He just got married recently. So I was, congratulations, Scott Capurro. So I wrote the show, and then Clown's Nose I got punched in the face on the tube and had my nose broken, and I tried to make myself feel better about it. And I wrote the song about how clown getting his nose broken. And then I kind of attribute it to what I should have done when Scott accused me of that. Instead of doing the whole show, I should have just said, no, I'm not homophobic, I just don't like you very much.
Certainly sounds better than Love Me Do as a background story.
Love Me
but
Don't.
Before I play it, why were you punched on the tube?
Random stranger, random violence, living in London. Deal with it.
Yeah,
it's not Canada.
Yeah, it doesn't happen in Canada.
No, it's not in Canada.
Here's a Clown's Nose. Be careful, people in London.
I close my eyes and drift away. We need the poor balloons and the big gay parade. Pink candy floss fades back to streets of grey because the clown's nose is broken. Cast my mind back to that unfortunate day. I have to admit to you, I got carried away. When I wiped that cherry smile off that made-up face, and now the clown's nose is broken. Say the clown's nose is broken, and it doesn't go. It goes, and it doesn't go. And it doesn't go, it goes. The clown's nose is broken. See, the clown's nose is broken. I've done my time for ABH. I know he was only small, just about 4'8". But he scratched my brand new car, and so I made him pay. Now the clown's nose is broken. See, the clown's nose is broken. And it doesn't go, it goes. And it doesn't go, it goes. And it doesn't go, it goes. The clown's nose is broken.
Yeah, nice ending there. Clowns Nose. Phil Nichol, who's with us here on FUBAR.
Sound effects always funny on FUBAR. FUBAR sound effects with Sean Hughes.
I think you will get some royalties for that.
Thank you very much.
So
you can use that one. You can peel that off and you... I'll do one read again.
So you're listening to FUBAR FM with Sean Hughes.
Well, I appreciate that. It sounds too Canadian, though. And you know my feelings towards Canadians.
All right. It's
mixed.
You're listening to FUBAR now, with Sean Hughes.
That's an Irish accent from maybe 15th century. Listen, we've had Iris from Uxbridge, blah, 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 about me. Yeah, thanks, Iris. But she wants to know, like, she knows you from the Juice Pigs. Because you're like, that's the first time I came across you as well.
Yeah.
Like, in Edinburgh, you kind of wowed everybody that first year, didn't you?
Do you remember the first show that we did? The very first show I did in Edinburgh was you were on the bill. It was a showcase for press, and it was the first day of Edinburgh at the Counting House, the old Gilded Balloon.
Yeah.
Addison Cresswell, who is dearly departed, has set up a gig, and it had, the bill was Jack D, Joe Brand, Mark Lamar, Jeff Green, Donna McPhail, Mark Thomas, Eddie Izzard, you, and Cork and the Juice Pigs.
Average.
I know.
None of us were any good.
A lot
good
of people
then,
left.
Though.
30 people, 30 tickets sold.
I know, it's weird. Like, but so the 3 years, there was 3 years in the band, yeah?
There was three of us in the band, yeah.
And so
Sean Cullen, Greg Neal, and me.
And so Sean's a comic still, isn't he?
Yeah, they're both doing comedy here and there.
Over here, yeah?
No, Sean lives in Toronto.
Right.
And Greg lives in Melbourne, and I live in London. We really broke up.
And was it nasty breakup?
It was horrible. It was knives. Mm. I let live bees go in his house. Just covered him, dipped his hand in honey while he was sleeping.
Yeah, bees and knives. That's not a good combo. Bees and
you can't beat a bee with a knife.
What?
It's like paper, scissors, rock, stone, or whatever.
Bruce Lee would be able to do it, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
But
what he would do is he would grab a hold of a bee and use it to bat away the other bees. He's good.
Yeah, I don't know if that would work, though. I'm thinking about it logically. I can't. I'd imagine. As a kid, I remember seeing The Swarm. Do you remember that film?
Yeah. That's a Canadian film.
You're claiming everything today.
It's David Cronenberg. It's The Swarm.
Right.
He's David Cronenberg. He's Canadian.
Yeah, but
they're all Canadians.
It was an American film, though.
Bill Hicks is Canadian. They're all Canadians.
Are you working with Canadian?
Tommy Tiernan, Canadian.
Yeah, well, very much. So when you broke up, you were always just going to go solo, or?
Yeah. Well, I actually didn't really have much because I came to Britain because my dear friend and now agent Lisa White was just setting up a management company, and so she helped me get some shows, get some gigs, and I got some great support from the Comedy Calf, and Noel Faulkner gave me gigs right away. My first gig in London was and Ed Byrne was on, you know,
right.
and they put me on after him, and I stunk the joint out. It was absolutely horrific.
And
I cried.
Right.
I think I might have even cried before I left the stage.
Well, it's good to have those moments.
Yeah. Not before you leave the stage.
But when, like, you're known as, like, a big closer as well, because, like, you really do get the crowd riled. Like, nobody likes to follow you because of your energy as well.
Yeah, it's just a lot of yelling and shouting, though.
You've got amazing energy.
Well, yeah, but that comes from me not being able to follow acts that actually do comedy for a living. So I'm not a natural comic. So I just get really loud, shouty, jump on the tables, put on a bit of a rock spectacular, and it kind of makes up for the fact that I don't have anything funny to say.
I had in Edinburgh, just gone, I did the benefit at the Playhouse, you know, which is the 5,000.
Well,
you're just doing 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But because where my show is on, I had to headline it. And there's no way I should have been headlining it. But who I followed was a band who were doing a cappella and beatbox. And you know what the audience are like. They just go nuts for that.
Yeah.
And then so they went on and people just go, wow, they're really clever.
Yeah.
And then just before me, a ventriloquist.
Oh, great.
Hi, come on, go.
Perfect. Hi.
All right.
I just talk.
I've very little to say.
Yeah,
how are you?
I know.
But listen, Phil, it's absolutely been adorable. So what is, where can people see you and give us the details for the electric watermelon?
Well, Late Night Electric Watermelon is going to be available for digital download only on Bandcamp on February the 24th.
Just for one day?
Yeah, it's one day, 1 hour, one. I'm selling it for 1 minute in February.
From then on, it'll be
out there on Bandcamp.
And you're selling it at gigs
No, because I've got no hard copies. It's only digital
what
download.
What is wrong with you, man?
There's nothing. No one buys CDs anymore.
Well,
this will.
That's one copy already.
You probably still have a, like, you know.
Yes, I've got a Walkman.
A wax tube that you roll. you know, from your youth.
I'm talking about technology in the show I'm doing at the moment. I'm like, right. you know the way kids are looking for the new iPhone.
Yeah.
But I remember my mind being blown by walkie-talkies.
Yeah.
You know, where you could hear someone in another
my
room.
Mind was blown by a cup with a string attached to another cup. That was amazing.
Yeah, so you know, all that good stuff you said about Canada gone right down there when you're letting us know what's happening over there.
That was in Scotland.
Listen, it's been absolutely adorable. Well, next time you come in, you can play live as well.
I'd love to.
So we're gonna, I think we're gonna play a track now, which I think I'm gonna hit the right button.
Okay.
And then we've got another fabulous comic coming in. I'm so lucky today. You know him yourself.
I do.
What do you think of him?
I think he's really good. I think he's great. I think he's looking at me now, so I'm going to tell you he's one of the nicest men in comedy.
I saw his show in Edinburgh, Mike Wozniak. He got nominated.
Mike Wozniak.
Yeah, he got nominated for the award this year.
He did.
Which you won the award a couple of years ago, didn't you?
I did in 2006. Yep.
And did that change things for you?
No.
Great stuff. Let's finish on that then. Here's I See a Darkness by Bonnie Prince Billy.
Many times we've been out drinking, and many times we've shared our thoughts. But did you ever notice the kind of thoughts I got? Well, you know I have a love for everyone I know. And you know I have a drive to live I won't let go. But could you see its opposition comes rising up sometimes? That it's dreadful, and the position comes blacking in my mind. And that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness. Did you know how much I love you? There's a hope that somehow you can save me from this darkness. Well, I hope that someday, buddy, we have peace in our lives. Together or apart, alone or with our wives, that we can stop our whoring and pull the smiles inside and light it up forever and never go to sleep my best unbeaten brother. This isn't all I see. Oh no, I see a darkness. Oh no, I see a darkness. Oh no, I see. Did you know how much I love you? Is a hope that somehow you can save me from this darkness.
That, my friends, is I See a Darkness by Bonnie Prince Billy. One of the few songs that actually makes me cry. But, you know, I've held it back because I'm a professional. And, yeah, Mike Walnick has come in. Thank you so much. I'll obviously put people into the frame, but the first question just come up, right. Text from Joe in Falkirk. Phil's gone, but I might as well ask you. what was Phil's favourite moment in his career?
I think it was probably the... I think any time he's been completely naked on stage, I think is when Phil is happiest.
That's just... that's a given on.
It's fairly standard for him. So, yeah, most nights. He's a very happy performer, is Phil Nichol, I'd say.
Do you have to be naked to be happy? Are you...
I don't know. I think he... I mean, you know, the further he can push it, the happier he is. He's a man of great extremes.
So Mike, I saw your show in Edinburgh, and congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you.
It's a lovely, lovely show. And,
thanks, mate.
But so, like, I got the impression, because I didn't know anything about you before that, that was obviously mainly you, but it's a character as well, really.
Yeah, it's kind of a slight, sort of shifted on version of me. So it's all, the show is entirely based on truth and real things.
That's the only way comedy should
and
ever
be. real human. And I've just kind of allowed myself to have a bit more of a sort of nightly meltdown with it than I would in ordinary life, I think.
No, which is beautiful. And is it that... Because I love the way it was constructed as well, because I like, you know, when people put a bit of effort. But was there nights where people were a bit... Well, it was daytime you played as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that was... In Edinburgh, that was lovely.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It kind of worked, because the show is a sort of failed show business kind of show. So the fact that it was on just after midday in a room where you could hear tram works going on throughout the day and children screaming kind of made it... It sort of added to that.
But was
element
it,
of it.
Was there an element of the audience who were going, is this guy serious?
Oh, completely.
Was that beautiful?
Oh,
to
no,
see
it's,
that?
It's wonderful. I mean, even I've just finished doing six nights in a row in Soho Theatre, and it was lovely every single night, apart from the last night where there were two very clear groups in the room. One of were enjoying it and understood what was happening, and the other, at least half of the room were just staring at me, going, "What on earth is wrong with this person? This isn't comedy. Why are the one liners what?"
But it was, like, and I hope this isn't unfair, but it did remind me, the character, slightly of Basil Fawlty.
Yeah.
Do you get that?
Yeah, there's a bit of that, and there's a bit of kind of Les Dawson, I think, and there's a sort of mishmash, I think.
But so, were you always a character comic then, or did you do stand-up as well?
Sort of normal stand-up, but I started doing sketch comedy originally.
Right.
And that was what I was doing before I went into stand-up. So I think that influenced the fact that when I do stand-up, it's slightly removed. It's not quite me. There's that safety buffer zone.
And is it, but like you were saying as well, like you actually still live in Exeter as well,
yeah.
Which is very unusual for a comic.
Well, because it's a total nightmare. That's why. It makes no sense. It's completely, it's really unfeasible. I spend half my life on trains. You know, it's a miserable existence.
Well, not at the moment. No one can get into Exeter, can they?
No, exactly. So I'm here. I haven't been home for over a week.
But Exeter is kind of a beautiful...
It's a lovely place, and it's near lots of very, very beautiful places, you know, the moor and the sea and all that kind of stuff.
But I played there last week, and I always like to look at the local paper to just...
Right.
For, like, not to get cheap laughs, but just to let people know that I have... in my shows, that it's not, like, word for word.
Yeah.
And your headline in your paper was... We are thinking of keeping the shops open an extra half an hour. That's the front page.
Yeah, people.
But not even we are. We are thinking.
We are thinking,
of
course. And people would have been wearing sandwich boards with that. You know, walking around the streets, making sure people know, ringing bells, and you know, everything would have stopped down. You know, stopped dead. Sunday services. You know, there would have been announcements.
And you've got an amazing museum there as well.
It's incredible. The museum is phenomenal. Yeah, the RAM.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Royal Albert Memorial Museum is amazing.
But do you go there much, or is it one of those because it's there, you never bother?
I go there tons because I've got a toddler. And so it's an amazing, because it has been raining in the southwest for the last sort of 3 years, solidly.
Yeah.
We can take her there to run around, and she can commune with the there's, you know, it's the kind of museum where there'll be a giraffe next to a harpsichord, which makes absolutely no sense, but it's beautiful. And well, you can press a button and the harpsichord plays, so she's thrilled. And well, she goes around dressed as a bee.
My mate was happy because... but they bigged it up too much. They said, we've got a new... they had an exhibition from New Zealand with the Maoris,
right.
And they bigged this up. So my mate was from New Zealand. He's really excited about going. And then I said, where's the exhibition? In that case over there.
It was just sort of a stuffed kiwi bird or something.
It was like three items, actually. there's Greg from Hereford, obviously a fan of yours, Mike. He wants to know, when did you start cultivating your magnificent moustache?
Oh, right. I think
it says tash, but I'm going to be proper.
Fine, why not? Well, this is FUBAR after all,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It was good. So it was 10 years
ago.
Hang on,
let's just check and see if it is FUBAR. Hang on.
FUBAR Radio.
Yep, you're back on the
confirmed,
money.
Yep, confirmed.
That's confirmed.
Excellent. That's one point. Yeah, 10 years ago was the first one I grew, I'd say. And obviously, it was grown as a joke, clearly. But I discovered that I quite liked it. And my wife tells me that I have an underdeveloped lower face.
We all have.
And she won't come anywhere near me if I'm not. I mean, I got married in this moustache. I mean, it was grown as a joke, but she just... The love of my life just prefers me this way. So that's just... I mean, I'm stuck with it now.
Well, I did a Miss Marple... And
oh,
I had to grow a moustache.
Yeah.
And I can grow them very quickly.
Yeah.
And I was in there. Pretty much all the male characters had moustaches right. In this period piece. And some of them were false. And the producer came in and he said, oh, too many people have moustaches. And went, Sean, can you take your false one off? Because obviously, do you dye it all? Because your hair, your moustache is the exact same colour as your hair, which is unusual.
Well, that's it. People assume it's false a lot of the time. And I think I'm too vain. I tend to spend too much time grooming it. So when people see it, they assume it's just...
But there's no grey or anything there.
No, that's just, that's just natural, great moustache.
It is actually, it's a fantastic moustache, I'll give you that. And so that's there for the foreseeable.
Yeah, basically, and also, I try and shave it off, because I sort of do a lot of comedy acting and stuff, and I try and persuade casting people, and hey, it's not just a moustache, I can do other things without the moustache. And whenever I shave it off, they're just, I get no work at all.
Because obviously, people, obviously we live in a TV literate world. Mm. And I loved the show, even though I can't remember.
Down.
Yeah, that was a great show.
Thank you.
Has that kind of changed things for you at all? Like,
I don't know. I'm not sure. It's kind of, it was a bloody lovely job.
Yeah, it's
coming
great,
back.
Yeah.
So in terms of sort of like having a nice chunk of work coming up and all that kind of thing and being generally less in a state of constant panic about work, that's kind of been lovely. And in terms of this is the first time I've tried touring a show.
Right. And that's because you can put that on the poster.
Yeah, and because I thought, maybe there's a chance someone, in Salford or Newcastle might, maybe have tuned in and liked the show and want to see what Brian Outmandown's like on stage and that kind of thing. So that's, so in that regard, it's been amazing.
But I guess, obviously they're not the same character, but they're not a million miles away from the character you're playing on stage as well. So it works well in that sense.
He's a straight man. Yeah, exactly. He's a frustrated sort of straight man. Although he's, the stage character goes to more, I think it's more openly distressed.
Do you get, with the writing process, I know Greg obviously writes it, but do you get to improvise around your bits?
We don't much, actually. And there's not much sort of need to. That's not really, this isn't one of those sitcoms when you do that. The sort of scripts just turn up just sort of funny.
Perfect.
As they are, exactly. They've
perfect.
Nailed it. And,
We'll play a song. What kind of music do you like, by the way?
A bit of everything, really.
Well, that's a bit vague, to be fair, Mike.
All right. Well, my favourite band of all time is probably Led Zeppelin.
Well, funnily enough, now that you mention it, here's Jesus and the Mary Jane.
Love on the edge of a knife, and the world.
Ashleen from Derby's asking, will we be playing anything that's actually been released in the last couple of years?
Yes! Yes, we will. Do you know what station this is? Well, if you don't...
FUBAR, giving radio the finger.
Right, now, Mike Walsh's in with me now. Naughty, Naughty Radio. How are you going to live up to that? And what are you going to do?
I don't know. I mean,
what is the naughtiest thing you've ever done?
Me, they're terrible. I've done terrible things in my life, none of which I want to talk about.
This is FUBAR. I'm intrigued now. You can make one up, but what is one of the naughtiest things you've done?
Oh my God!
Because you're like, I'm only coming from the point that you seem so clean living.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's a sort of very carefully constructed veneer, come from a sort of past of sort of terrible, terrible, terrible crimes, which I wish not to be discovered.
So, did you go to university and stuff?
I did. Yeah.
So, where did you go?
I went to medical school originally, in London. Yeah, a place called St George's. Yeah.
What, to learn to become a doctor?
That was the plan. That was plan A.
And did you go through the whole course?
I did, yeah.
See, you don't go on about it like Harry Hill. You didn't do... even on that Britain's Funniest Videos, he still goes, I was a doctor, by the way. every second link.
No, so, I try not to make a thing of it.
Well, good on you for doing that.
I don't want to sort of fall into the sort of Phil Hammond trap. You know, bless him, I've never met the man. He might be a lovely man, but...
He's
not. Sort of doing sort of medical anecdotes on Countdown, for years.
But are you a properly trained doctor then?
I was just sort of junior plod for a few years, you know, that was it, you know, around sort of little hospitals in London and Devon and, you know, just a little kind of, you know.
Yeah, but you're kind of like, that's quite, you know, a doctor's
by day and then just
to
sort
do.
Of, you know, gigging at night until eventually I could sack it and, you know.
No, tell me this now, and this isn't me just being crass for the sake of it, this is actually a proper question.
Yeah.
Have you done prostate with guys?
Of course, yeah.
Right, which is absolutely normal. It's not me kind of going, ooh, finger up the arse, isn't that funny?
Yeah.
But the point I'm getting at, I got that done by my local doctor without warning.
How was it?
Very enjoyable.
Yeah, well, people joke about it, but I think, I mean, within the medical profession, that most people that I knew prided themselves on being able to make it very comfortable.
Well, no, honestly, like...
I mean, we would discuss techniques, for example, you know, we'd make sure it was nicely lubricated, that they're in a good position.
Well, you're wearing a glove anyway.
You're wearing a glove, and also making sure that there's a lovely technique you can do where the pad of your index finger, if you take your time, just gently press on the anus.
While kissing the patient.
While gently caressing the patient's lower back with your lips. That pad of finger, if you just give it a moment, then the anus will just slightly soften. And then you go in, rather than trying to sort of charge straight in.
But
it's a great technique, beautiful.
Well, I don't think he did that. Like, but my point, and this is why I'm bringing it up, is he's the only man or woman who's ever had his finger up my ass.
Sure.
So I feel like there's a connection.
But thumbs.
No, but
strong history of thumbs.
No, but yeah, that's a given.
Sure.
Yeah, I come from apes. but the point is, I sometimes see him in the street and I feel like I should ask him, should we go for a coffee? Because we've had this moment together.
Because, yeah, but I don't want to be cold, I don't want to break it to you, but he might not even remember it.
No, that's what I'm just totally from
you
my
know,
point
I mean,
of view.
To a penny for him, I mean, he'd have seen quite a lot of anuses in his time and... You know, some more memorable than yours. I mean,
well, that's a given as well.
Who knows? I mean, you know, you see all sorts. You know, I mean, I'm.
Well, surely they're all pretty similar, aren't they?
No, good God, no! All sorts of things can go wrong with your anus. I mean,
so when you're putting the finger up there, like, there's a whole Discovery Channel there.
Oh yeah, I mean, even on the out, you know, just the external, just the, you know, the aperture itself. You know, I mean, I've got one that looks like a casserole, to be honest. and then beyond that, when to get past that, all sorts of things can go wrong: bumps and grooves, and you know. Foreign bodies, all kinds of things.
Would you mind doing a check?
I've got time. Fine, sure.
Shall I put on a long track?
A long track, innit?
But
but in a webcast.
But was it a situation where, so you just tired of that really quickly then?
No, I think I just ended up in the wrong thing. I just went to a very kind of dry grammar school where you were supposed to join the Navy or become a doctor. And if you really were wild, then maybe become a barrister. That was the kind of school it was.
And you were brought up in Exeter as well?
This is in Portsmouth where I grew up.
Right.
As my wife's family from Exeter. So, yeah, but then so just ended up
finger
on this...
Finger right under the thumb.
And it's kind of, it is incredible. If you have a certain kind of background, you can, it sounds ludicrous, I sound like a total tosser saying this, but you can end up on a kind of conveyor belt that takes you into medical school. That sounds awful.
No, you are thinking of the Generation Game.
Oh, of course, yeah, right. Jet skis and white goods. Yeah. Right. Okay, fine.
So what happened then? You just started doing comedy, or was it acting?
I did a play in my last year of school, which they didn't do much of, and completely loved it. And at that point, I think I made a terrible mistake. And then I went to a medical school. It's the same one that Harry Hill went to, and Paul Sinha, and a few other kind of comedy types.
Right.
Where there was a big kind of sketch, like review sort of scene.
I didn't know that.
And just got into, that's just what I spent all of my time doing. Didn't turn up to lectures, just spent time organising Edinburgh shows and taking little shows off to clubs and RAF bases in Anglesey and other universities and stuff. That's just all I spent my time doing.
But now I take it, are you kind of pushing more in towards the acting now?
I don't know. I don't think I have a plan. I'm just having a bloody lovely time and I'll sort of see what comes up. I think I get slight, I mean, stand-up wise, I love stand-up. I imagine myself always doing
that's
stand-up.
What you are.
Yeah, but I can't imagine myself ever sort of, filling an arena doing what I do. And I'm quite happy for it to be my own little thing that I love, and I don't have to worry about trying to sort of fit someone else's bill.
I know what you mean. It's that weird thing of
a bit of like comedy acting, a little bit of voice work, whatever, I can just, have fun old things to make a living, I'll just take.
And eventually you'll move to London, yeah?
Well, we talk about it. I mean, if we do it, then we'll have to live in a wheelie bin. I mean, that's it.
But no, but I think it's really refreshing that you're living in Exeter.
It's fun,
But it's so. But
it's fun and it's a nightmare. It's both,
And so, are you on tour at the moment then?
Yeah, but a very kind of like tour in the loosest sense. Like it's 20 dates over kind of 5 months, very scattered about.
You got a T-shirt with all the dates on
it? Oh, yeah, there's merch. Of course there's merch. There's key rings and, headbands and sweats, all that kind of stuff.
Moustaches
and grooming
gloves
kits.
Gloves for the old finger things.
Nose trimmers, everything, the usual. Same. I've taken the same as your kind of portfolio and I've just, copied it.
It's all about the money.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're not doing Edinburgh this year then?
I can't, no, because Mandown's coming back. We're filming it over August and September, which I'm very excited about.
That's great.
I should hopefully be out in the autumn. Yeah, it will be out in the autumn. I know it will be out in the autumn.
And so, did I not notice you were doing some work in progress as well?
I'm trying, because I thought I was going to Edinburgh, so I've already started thinking about the next show.
Right.
And so most of them are with this lovely club called The Invisible Dots. Do you know?
I'm aware of that. They do great stuff.
They're lovely,
Obviously now it's a long way away because you're not doing it for a while, but just my own curiosity, what's the new show about?
So the working title is Master of Disguise. So the idea is that it's...
Where's he gone?
The idea is that it's about the sort of gap between, thought and deed. So actually how you behave and actually the sort of ugly thoughts going on in your head. And the balance I'm trying to get right at the moment is confessing the sort of terrible things I think about.
Is it in a similar vein or this is like just
totally...
It'd be
slightly different, I think.
It sounds different, that's why...
It'd be different.
Because there's a line I do in the new show, which is, I think probably you get to a certain age, you start thinking about things like that, but I just talk about, when someone says, what are you thinking? I said, that's a human rights issue. Why should I have to tell you what I'm thinking? Are you not allowed to have any thought of your own anymore? Because if I, actually audibly said the things I was thinking, I'd probably be put in prison.
It would be all over. Yeah, of course.
This has been a joy. Have you got a website that people...
I've got a very poorly homemade website that I've done myself called MrMikeWozniak.com. That's it. Feel free to check it out. It's basically two pages.
And what's the dates and what?
Pretty much. Some dates, some links to some YouTube clips, the ones I want you to see rather than the ones I don't want you to see, which are the ones that are more prominent on YouTube.
You might as well...
Control the image in some way.
Since you've told us about your beautiful career, what would be... your tip for people avoiding flu this winter?
Avoiding flu? I would avoid my children.
Right, well, that's good enough for me. Look, it's been an absolute pleasure. We're actually going to play a track off the playlist, but I love them there. Have you heard of The National?
I haven't actually, no.
Mike, God, everyone's going, oh, Mike came across really well there. And he just lost it at the last minute. Thank you so much. That was a fantastic band, The National, Demons. Now, a very special guest come in. We've had a couple of comics in, and I know it's FUBAR and it's all that, but Sean Lyons come in. Sean, hello, how are you?
Sean, I was having a cigarette outside in between.
Don't spoil the magic.
Oh.
I'm pretending we'd planned this out for months.
Of course we had, yeah, and I'd forgotten about it and was having a cigarette outside.
Waiting. Yeah. No, but because weirdly, it's that one of those weird things where I recognise your face straight away and then I kind of knew it was journalism, but then as you said it, like you did this incredible. Like, well, basically, did you start off as a journalist?
I was a print journalist.
Right.
Not very successful. And then fell into war.
Yeah.
And started making documentaries about me in war zones.
Yeah,
and
which is a very odd thing to do.
But I did quite well because I had no training as a news journalist. So unlike John Simpson and more serious war correspondents, I wouldn't ask the Taliban their strategic plans. I'd ask them what they had for lunch.
Which is what we want to know.
And no one had ever asked them that.
But so you just went, right, I'm going to start going to war zones, which is, you know, it's going to put your life in danger because you pretty much were a one-man band. It was just you and a sound recorder?
The bizarre truth is I had been doing sort of lifestyle music journalism, and I, at the end of the rave days, I think I got to that point where there was only so many South London DJs you can interview without going insane.
Right. Well, yeah, two.
And then, yeah... I think I interviewed, I won't mention any names. And then I just had a lucky break where I was doing a story about a kidnap case in Kashmir, and the BBC said, do you mind bringing along a video camera and doing a video diary?
Well, so initially it was just to go over as a journalist?
As a journalist for a magazine, and I filmed a video diary about me looking for these five British tourists who'd been kidnapped by Islamic terrorists. And you know the way life works, that documentary did well, so the BBC then were like, well, you're the go-to guy for Islamic terrorists.
Right.
Why didn't you go to this country called Afghanistan? This is before 9/11.
But you say that like you've never heard of Afghanistan before.
Well, this was 1999.
Right.
And the Taliban were actually running the government, if you can use that word. They couldn't really run a well, certainly couldn't run a bar, but they were hopeless. But no one had made a documentary about the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, and I'd barely heard of it, didn't know much. My previous job before going off there, I was a financial correspondent doing the easy guide to money for The Guardian. Next thing, I'm in Afghanistan with the Taliban regime and discovered they banned filming, which made it quite difficult.
Yeah.
And then 9/11 happened, which obviously is bad news, but was good for my career because...
There's always a positive. There's always a positive.
And I don't mean that to be glib in any way at all. So that kind of set me on this trajectory. And for the next 10 years, I was in Afghanistan, Iraq, making documentaries.
Yeah, but then the shit went down, though, didn't it?
It was only going to end in one way. I made a film called Tea with the Taliban, Meeting the Taliban, Fighting the Taliban, and eventually you're either
going to... It's like the kind of Meet the Fockers franchise.
Well, unlike that one, I made less money, and it was only going to end up either being killed or kidnapped by the Taliban, and luckily for me, I was kidnapped by the Taliban.
But did you seriously think this is how it's going to end up?
You know...
Have you got a death wish is what I'm asking.
Bizarrely, I've often been asked that. I think what happens is, I look back on it. So what happened, I'd made this documentary called Meeting the Taliban for Channel 4, where I was filming with them, fighting the British, and I was also seeing it from the British side, getting very close. And then I think what happens, a bit like Icarus flying ever closer to the sun,
yeah.
You're aware that this is going to end badly, but you just can't help yourself because you're being carried away.
So it's like an addiction, really.
I hate to admit it, but it is. And then I, for this film, which was never made, I crossed the border into the tribal areas, and this looks like a suicide proposal, not a TV one. I proposed to cross the border from Afghanistan into the tribal areas to make a film about their secret training camps with Al-Qaeda, and that was never going to...
But at this point, did you have... Because there's always a fixer involved with these situations. So did you have someone on the ground who was negotiating all this?
Yeah, I would spend 6 months at a time in Afghanistan setting these films up, and I ended up being kidnapped with my fixer.
Right.
And we spent 4 months in captivity.
Because also, just slightly off the point, but don't you have kids as well, yeah?
Got two children.
Yeah. So, but like, I can understand someone having that kind of attitude, gung-ho, but when you've got two kids, that must have made you think... Because I think even in the film, does that not come across?
No, there was a BBC... drama about it where an actor, Dougie Henshaw, played me.
Right.
So I never made the documentary about my kidnap, funny enough.
Surely you were there in an advisory situation.
Oh, yeah, but so the drama made about it, yeah, I helped write that. And I did, during my captivity, I thought, and that almost broke me, that, you know, the guy I was with had a breakdown, he went mad, but what nearly broke me was thinking, what kind of dad am I worrying about the diapers, schools they go to when I keep going off playing Russian roulette? So since then, I vowed never to work with Islamic extremists hell-bent on killing Westerners like myself.
How long did they have you in captivity for?
In what I now call Hotel Taliban, I was a guest of theirs for 3.5 months in a dark room.
Oh, man, and you didn't go crazy?
It's a bit like being a radio DJ in this little studio.
I'm sorry, but the hospitality hasn't been great. Get us some bread. But and also, like, even though 3.5 months doesn't sound long, you were told, like, it wasn't like you knew you were getting out after 3.5 months, so this is endless.
Well, for 10 years I've been covering war zones, interviewing insurgents, Islamic terrorists, whatever you want to call them, with British and American soldiers in combat. And it never seemed real. It always felt like I was an observer watching a movie unfold around me in Technicolor. But for the first time in my life, when I was sitting in that room, being told I was about to be executed.
What, every day?
No. It was hanging over me like the sort of Damocles, the threat of death. But no, on one particular day, they came in and said, well, you're going to be executed. And that's at that point, I said, look, I've got a slight problem with having my throat cut. Do you mind if I'm shot? I was having those kind of conversations, like, and that's when death came.
Where was your
real
state of mind, like, there, then?
Bizarrely, the weird thing is, when you know you're going to die, it's a bit like Scrooge looking back, with having the ghost of Christmas past visiting you at night. It's a terrifying experience, but it also gives you an amazing look on life, and you can see everything with immense clarity your entire life, where you went wrong, where you went right, how to put it, you know, like Scrooge, he wakes up Christmas Day, he knows exactly what he should do.
I haven't seen the film, but thanks for spoiling it.
Right, sorry. Unlike Scrooge, I thought, though, the irony would be having been shown how to put my life right, death would then take me out and cut my throat. But so bizarrely, it was not an unpleasant experience in the sense that cut off from the world and my loved ones, I've never felt quite so in love with my children, my family. So it had its up points.
Yeah, but tell us this, Sean.
I don't want to go through it again.
Yeah, exactly. But also, because like I had a situation where I was in the tsunami and I could have easily died.
Right.
And what, like, you were in a much, actually, a more severe situation, but you think this is going to change you for the rest of your life, but it doesn't, does it? Are you back to your normal self?
Sad thing is, when I was in there, thinking, if by some miracle I have a second chance at life, I'm going to come out like a cross between Jesus Christ and Mother Teresa. A week later, I'm in a club in Portobello Road, drinking a strawberry daiquiri, chatting up a girl, using my near-death experience merely as a way to seduce her.
Right.
And I know at that point, being a half-Irish Catholic, I'm going straight to hell.
But that's what I mean. You just went, because I remember...
Didn't change at all.
I remember about a week later when I realised I was still watching Neighbours that I wasn't taking each day as it comes.
No. It's hard to live life that intensely.
I must tell you, there's such a famous thing. Who's the Irish guy who got kidnapped in the Lebanon? Brian...
John McCarthy and Brian Keenan.
Yeah, Brian Keenan. You know, this is classic Irish humour where... Because everyone who doesn't know, basically, Keenan was basically just shoved in the boot of a car and just taken to this place. And apparently when he got back to Belfast, he was getting a taxi, and the taxi went, "Would you be more comfortable in the boot?"
I've heard that from Terry Way, and every time any of those lot go to Northern Ireland, they're the same joke is made.
But no, I think it is absolutely, like, obviously it's funny, but I don't think it's a joke. I think that's what you know, the Irish people are like now. Yeah. Listen, Sean, this has been a very beautiful incidental. And you spell yours the proper way as well.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to get another documentary off the ground, so we give that a plug. So what's happening with this?
No, you can give a plug. I've been trying. It's a bit like pulling teeth, though, writing a book about my experience, which is due out. It's called Hotel Taliban. So I'm working on that at the moment. But I'm missing documentaries. So at the moment, I'm in development for a BBC project about... Oddly enough, kidnap and ransom.
Well, listen, good luck with that. And when that happens, we'll have you in. Is there any particular music that you really love? Because we're about to play a tune. Wouldn't it be a weird coincidence if it was...
Well, if you show me what you're about to play, I could say that.
I'm just going to... It's already been a magical coincidence. So, do you like orange juice?
That band from the 80s. I actually remember that lot.
Here we go. Thank you so much.
Locked in the confines of
The magnificent orange juice there with the artisans. Now, we're going to try and do this as a weekly thing. I've got a young student in here now called Ben. I don't even know your surname, Ben. Is that important?
Not really. It's Phillips, though, if you want it.
Well, I've got it now. Now, basically, I've been slightly obsessed that so many young people tend to study philosophy and then they don't do jobs that are... They don't become philosophers. So, Ben, you're a second-year student of philosophy. Two quick questions. One is, why have you studied philosophy?
I studied it because I was kind of arguing all the time, up to the point where people probably thought I was a bit of a prick. So I thought, instead of always arguing with my mates, with my family all the time, I should probably start arguing like with students and do a degree out of it.
But what were you having arguments, like, what, proper philosophical?
Yeah, like proper philosophical arguments all the time. Like, it would start when I was younger, when I'd be doing it about eating my vegetables and stuff, like when I was really young. Then I'd be getting into more, like, political stuff. Then we started sort of talking about the big issues. I don't know, it was a weird group of friends.
Yeah.
Instead of talking about, well, we talked about, you know, girls and stuff, also just philosophy.
And so what do you hope to do when you leave university?
Me and one of my mates said we'd love to be sort of like philosophy professors when we're older, but because of the money and everything, probably not. So,
but that's what I mean. But there's so many people study philosophy, but they don't become.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. I guess you can be sort of a part-time philosopher. Like, you can still read about it, you can still discuss it. But in terms of what I want to be, probably something in the media, I reckon, hopefully.
There's too many people doing that, Ben.
Yeah,
even
exactly.
Though you do have a lovely sounding voice.
Oh, thank you very much.
So tell me, now this is the big question, is so what did you learn philosophically this week?
This week we sort of learned about the difference, if there is a difference between computers and the human brain. So that film, Her, that's just come out, it was sort of related to that. So at what point does a sort of really intelligent computer actually become a mind that sort of has intelligence and can really think for itself instead of just being a computer?
What's springing to mind with me is when the chess computer beat?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's when that all kind of pretty kicked off.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. We spoke about that, yeah, and like the Turing test where you can't tell whether you're speaking to a human or a computer.
Right.
And so people say maybe that means that the two are pretty much the same thing.
But like you said, I'll always come from the situation where all the intelligence that a computer has been given by a human, so...
Yeah, well, that's exactly the point. So what people say is that if you've programmed a computer, then that's different from a mind. So if you can get a computer to read all the Chinese symbols in the Chinese dictionary, then it doesn't really understand Chinese.
Yeah.
It's just been taught to sort of translate it, whereas humans are actually able to understand things. But
less.
But then those two sort of sound similar, so it's difficult.
So would you all get together and discuss this as a group, or do you write a paper on it?
So we sort of discuss it as a group, then we write a paper on it. So you discuss it as a group and everyone gives their opinions. Then you kind of decide on one, then you write a paper on it.
Do you get marked on that then?
Yeah, we get marked on it, which is good when the lecturer likes it, but then sometimes the lecturer just won't agree with what you're saying.
But see, that's not fair.
Yeah,
because
no, exactly, it's not at all.
So if you don't agree with what his theory is, but you put a brilliant argument the other case, he just goes, no, you're not getting a good mark.
Well, I mean, most are pretty fair about it. So if they think you've made a good argument, then they'll like it. But the thing with philosophy is that a lot of the time when someone has a view, they sort of really have that view and they don't really like the other side. So it's sometimes
But that's not even philosophy. Everyone's a bit like that.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, I mean, my lecturers have been good about it this year. Like, I've disagreed with them on things and they've still liked the essays.
Ben, I obviously barely know you, but just from the little bit you're saying, you like to disagree with people anyway, don't you?
Yeah, a little bit. Less so, actually. That's been, like, the main benefit of a philosophy degree, to be honest. I kind of argue with people in real life less because I can just go to a class and do it for an hour.
But I take it a lot of it is like, is there many lectures or is it just a lot of coursework yourself?
It's most, at the uni I go to, it's mostly lectures, then a little bit of coursework.
That's unusual nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. A lot of my mates up north, especially actually, and in Scotland, they do loads and loads of essays all the time. And I think considering how much you're paying, it's better to be, you know, getting loads of contact time with the teachers.
And so what was, obviously that you get back to your studies now, but what, Ben, was your best argument within the computer versus the mind?
The computer versus the mind. I think it actually relates to that thing about the chess you said. I mean, the fact that there's a difference between something being really intelligent and being able to process things and then actually being able to come up with things itself. I mean, a computer can deal with anything you give it, but it can't sort of invent things, which I think a human can do.
Well, listen, I've really liked chatting to you, so hopefully you'll come in again.
Cheers, John. And, thanks a lot.
This next track, take a bend, you're what, 21, 22?
I'm only 19, actually.
I was trying to be nice. Of course you look 19. I don't want you going away with a complex thinking you look a lot older than you do. This guy, I'm going to play Tony Joe White. You won't have heard of him.
I have not. Still alive,
but he was... this was probably taken before you were actually even born, and this is As the Crow Flies. Cheers, Ben. Thanks very much for coming in. Nice, eh? Tony Joe White. Yeah, some of you will be Googling that later on with your modern technology. Now, I'm delighted and also a little bit ashamed. I'm just going to introduce Chris TT, who... Now, Chris, you're a musician and you've been going for such a long time, haven't you?
I have, yeah. Late 90s, maybe.
Well, I'm ashamed that I haven't heard of you because you're great.
Oh, thank you very much. So, you're allowed not to have heard of me. I'm not, like, famous or anything.
No, but I have a very keen interest in music, so I'm pissed off at myself, to be fair.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll let you have that. I'll take that on board as a sort of a... Yeah, that makes me feel good in a way.
Well, yeah, because it must be... It's harder now for musicians, isn't it?
Much harder. I mean, because in a way, I don't think I'd be able to even start now.
Really?
It's much easier to get stuff out there in the first place, you know, using the internet. Yeah. But then to take that step where it can become even something resembling a career is, I think, it's almost impossible.
So do you make money from doing live shows?
Yeah, I do from shows, a bit from radio play, a bit from... sometimes a couple of other people have covered my songs and had a few bits of money that way, or playing on other people's material as well.
Because isn't it really weird that, like, you know, people had said about the internet in general that, oh, it's freedom of information, it's going to be great for getting things out there. But it's kind of killed off a lot of stuff, though, hasn't it?
I think it's imposed communism on a load of creative people before the rest of society is ready for it.
Like, well, I'm going to have to get Ben back in. I didn't get much of that.
But all I mean is that we're like told, oh, we have to give everything away for free and then just kind of live, don't know, whereas no one else is doing that. If the whole world was giving everything away for free and we're all safe and we're all given homes and food and TVs for nothing... For whatever creative endeavour we did.
It's a very good point,
It would be brilliant, but at the moment it's like, well, you guys try it out for the rest of us.
I know.
You know? I mean, it's your trade as well. It's incredibly tough now.
But how many albums... Like, you brought out quite a few albums, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm on the album that came out just at the end of last year. It's called The Bear. It's number 9. And so my first album came out in 1999.
And are they brought out kind of by yourself? Or?
The first one was, then I got signed, then I did 4 albums for one record label, which is a little kind of folky indie label in London called Snowstorm.
Right.
And then I did something on my own again, and then I got signed. I'm signed now to a kind of punk folk label called Extra Mile Recordings, and they're quite a big... concern as an indie label. So I'm still, in a way, still taking that old model and running with that.
Like, I don't want to talk too much before, because I always like, you know, I like people to hear your music. But you have changed your style over the years, haven't you?
Yeah, I just got older and got... Yeah, I started off doing psychedelic pop music for a few years, and then...
Would like be just like kind of like new wave?
Yeah, a bit psyche, a bit...
Julian Cope?
A bit Acid Fried, and yeah, Cope and Robin Hitchcock and...
Right.
Stuff like trying to do that kind of enjoy myself doing wibbly noises on top of what are basically quite mainstream pop songs.
Well, I think you should just be a producer going, right, I'm going to put some wibbly noises on your classic pop tunes.
Yeah, get a pop star, put some wibbly noises on, and then we'd like it as well, and then you'd have the...
And so you've changed in the sense of mellowing?
Well, then I made one folk protest album, like proper political protest record, and from then on I was just called a protestinger by everyone. I'm like a dirty communist protest singer, and that was... I got labelled then. That was back in 2005, but I still find now that's what I get called most, is like a kind of protest
singer. And it's not appropriate anymore?
No, it's just one album among 9.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you put your heart on your sleeve, then you live or die by that tag, I guess.
And one question before we get you doing the business, which we'll pay you for, for royalties, not...
It's great. No, it's great. This sort of thing's perfect, because then people hear it and buy records.
You supported Carter, the Unstoppable Sex Machine.
Yeah.
Now, like, I like them, but their fans are fairly fanatic. Was that a really hard gig to do?
No, I've had a really nice run with their fans, because I've done a lot of work with Jim.
Right.
I'd say, I mean, you know them of old.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd say Jim is my best friend in the world of music.
And people
much.
Know that, then.
And yeah, so I've produced some of his solo albums and played piano for him a lot. So there have been several tours where it's been him doing his thing, and me in the background on stage playing piano.
Oh, cool.
And so that's been great. And, you know, he does these big orchestra shows now occasionally, just like one-off shows.
I didn't know that. No.
Yeah, he does we just did Bush Hall at the end of last year.
Right.
Where he did a show with a 26-piece orchestra, the Mystery Fax Machine Orchestra that Martin White runs.
Okay.
And I was playing piano for that. So I basically got to play a whole gig playing piano in an orchestra, which is... Pretty much heaven. It's pretty much the best thing you possibly do.
So, could you play lots of instruments then? Yeah,
I can to a sort of various degrees. I can certainly play lots of instruments to satisfy myself. But I wouldn't be good enough to be like a session player in someone else's
band.
And
have you got your own studio at home now, or do you actually go?
Recorded with an old friend at a place called One Cat in Brixton, which is nowadays it is a kind of commercial working studio, but it was built in someone's home and grew organically over the years.
Cool. Well, look, I'll put a track on. This is Misha P. Hinson. Have you heard of her?
Yeah, that's great.
At last, our promise. That's a very strange
name.
It's
a beautiful song.
Oh, everything he does is beautiful. Here it is.
At last, they agreed we were sane, though sometimes I just don't feel the same. At last, we've gone on our ways, though sometimes I just wish you could have stayed. And it's all your fault. It's all your fault. It's all your fault. It's all your fault. At last, all our promises turn to shit. And do you ever remember then? At last, we found something that we can all change. And it's all my fault. It's all my fault. It's all my fault. It's all my fault.
The tremendous Misha P. Hittinson there with At Last Our Promise. Now, I promise you live music, and live music you will get. The wonderful Chris TT is coming in. There he is, warming up. So you're about to sing a song. Chris, is there anything you want to say about the song before you do it?
It's rude. And it's called Bury Me With a Scarab, and it's a single, and it's kind of about...
A scarab as in a sword?
As in the old beetle.
Right.
Like the Egyptian beetle.
Okay.
Which is, it's just like a little beetle that runs around, but it's also a real ancient pre-Christian sort of symbol of all sorts of things.
So is this...
It's like a religious icon for right. ancient Egyptians.
Well, I'm glad you... I didn't know that, so that the song will make a little bit more sense
It can
me.
Spray you as well, apparently. If you go in too near a little scarab beetle, it can like spray a little into your face and
right.
cause you damage. Not a huge amount. It's not like a...
So do you, like, is this a period of time that you take some influence from, or...?
No, it's... what should I say about it? It's just another religious thing about oppression or about the way people see stuff. The song's about if you've got huge odds and you're being kind of defeated but refusing to admit it. It's like a loser like me going, no, you were... It's like the knight in the Knights of Nim, who's got like one limb left.
Okay, well, listen, I think... Well, I'm certainly looking forward to listening to it. I'll let you get on with it,
yeah? Oh, my God. Are you ready, Chris? I've got to sing it as well. I've got to stand by my erratic description.
You good to go?
Of this song. Yeah, definitely.
Listen to Fubar.
It's 2,000 years old. Bury me with a wooden Buddha, stretched out ears and a smile of gold. Bury me with a cross of Jesus on a photograph soaked in piss. But bury me with an internet connection for when you start regretting that it came to this. 1 nail, 2 nail, 2 nail, 3. You better nail that coffin lid down on me. 1 nail, 2 nail, 2 nail, 3. I'm not as dead as you thought I'd be. Bury me. Bury me. Bury me with a guard of honor, a pipe and a drum and a dumb salute. Or in a ditch when the storm's upon us, no one gives a shit about the rotten fruit. Bury me however you like, rituals or bonfires, knock yourself out. But bury me deep and keep on running. It won't be deep enough, no, there's no doubt. 1 nail, 2 nail, 2 nail, 3. You better nail that coffin lid down on me. 1 nail, 2 nail, 2 nail, 3. I'm not as dead as you thought I'd be. It's always uphill all the way, and uphill all the way back. Never will you ever find a corner worth cutting on the way. That road's a trap. It's a trap. But just when I finished that last verse, something fell out of my guitar. A shiny black, massive black spider. Yeah, nature is having the last laugh. And now that I'm getting near the chorus, I'm not gonna sing it again. I can't go back to telling the story till I know where the spider went. It's always uphill all the way, uphill all the way back. Never will you ever find a corner worth cutting on the way. That road's a trap. It's always outside looking in, or inside looking out. Never will we ever feel the weather if together we can blow away all doubt. Blow away the doubt. So anyway, they buried me and nailed it down. My hands were tied and they cut my hair. But in the spring, when they come back, they can dig all they like. I'm not there.
Me likes. Nice one, Chris TT. Great. It's great to see some anger again in music. Because, like, is there a movement now, a political movement in music, or is it just so underground?
I think music itself is a much smaller part of people's lives because we're not one
that,
united audience anymore.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So everyone listens to 1,000 of different things, but they're also playing 1,000 different computer games, watching 1,000 channels instead of 5. And so the problem is, yes, my answer would be definitely yes. There are massive musical, political movements out there. There's loads of great hip-hop stuff, loads of grime stuff in this country. And actually, there is a sort of burgeoning folk acoustic, like quite classic protest movement coming back. There are a lot of young artists out there influenced by Frank Turner, Billy Bragg. There's Grace Petrie out there. There's like Le Sac versus Pip are a really political duo, even though they're doing poetry over beats. It's still, it's got a kind of classic protest feel about it.
I guess we're never ever going to have another punk movement, though, are we?
I always think that the Coders are the new punks. I always think that looking for it in music is the wrong place. We aren't. I think you're right. We won't ever
For that very reason you said.
We won't have punk in a specific art form. What we have is like Anonymous is a really punk, terrifying global movement, and it culturally is. It takes its memes from our arts. So it takes like Alan, what's his name's mask for V for Vendetta and turns it into this great kind of symbol that mask that people are wearing that means Anonymous. But actually their process isn't art. It's like kind of, it's programming. It's computer programming.
Do you tend to join up a lot of these organisations and like get involved?
I'm a singer-songwriter and I'm also a coward, so I don't get involved. I tend to shout a lot on social media and write things, and occasionally that has an effect, and I kind of...
But don't you turn up at big talks and stuff? And
I do, yeah, I do some talks, and I generally try and get involved in not just political stuff, but cultural. I get really obsessed with cultural stuff.
Right, well, what's obsessing you about culture at the moment, then?
Well, just this thing that we've gone online and, we're talking about the exact thing, which is that it supposedly makes everything easy for us, but actually what it does is it forces us into a role of being the guinea pig for the whole rest of the world. I love futurism. I love this whole, that, what do they call it, futurology or whatever it is, where people are making much more kind of nuanced predictions about the way things are going to be.
Right.
But they do tend to be doomsayers. I mean, it does tend to look really terrifying.
Yeah, even when you, like the news this week, when they found those like very old kind of footprints.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
you go,
exactly.
Well, so if that was that many, many years ago, that means we will all be in water at some point again, and there will be an ice age, and there will be all that.
Yeah.
Hope you're listening, Fubar. Our lives aren't worth living. Simon and Essex,
we might as well just give up. This is terrible.
But no, it's. I've been asked here about who inspires your writing, but I think you've pretty much answered that yourself, though, really.
Yeah, and I'll admit Springsteen is a key influence, and I know people will say, oh, that's cheesy, but he's definitely.
See, weirdly, I had this conversation last night, it was which I'll ask you as well now, because it's actually quite an interesting question. It was at a do, and they said, what is the one person that you don't get that everyone loves? And I had to say Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, do you know Tom Robinson doesn't get Springsteen either? And so that's really interesting because you guys are, like, it's having a real creative thing, but not. I wonder if it's to do with heart on sleeve. Like if your mindset is to prick versus sort of slightly
possibly,
because he is schmaltzy. There's a load of schmaltz in Springsteen.
But see, I admire him and I know he's good. Mm. It's just I don't
get it.
You just
don't get it.
Yeah.
Have you got an equivalent?
Well, now kind of his is the one, but who'd be your one that everyone loves and you just don't get?
Oh, there's tons, and they might annoy you, like the Smiths or the Pixies.
Get out,
or the Pixies. Like everyone in my band, everyone I know adores Pixies, right? And I admire it. It's exactly what you just said. I admire it. I recognise the quality. You know,
But so, what is it you don't like about the Pixies?
It's I find it boring.
All right. Well, that's
fair enough. It's not a choice. Even, you know, I would desperately love to like Pixies.
Because plus,
it's a kind of big fat bloke with really cool band, which is what I am. So I ought to love Pixies, and you know they ought to be a perfect influence.
Yeah. See, but that's like I have to just take your opinion. But like it is that thing of Doctor or Doolittle, whatever that album was called, that changed my life. I thought that was just so amazing. The way, like, they moved music on a little bit. Even you could see all their influences, but they did really.
My wife as well is a huge Pixies fan and has all the records on vinyl. And
what's your problem with the Smiths?
Well, they're just, for me, they're just not. Well, it's really hard to explain. I bet my best argument that I do to wind musical people up is, I do a kind of pseudo-intellectual explanation of why Deacon Blue are a much more important band culturally than the Smiths. Well, and it just winds people up really badly.
Because sometimes I think the Smiths, like, if I'm in a bad mood, you go, well, they're a bit rockabilly, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
But I just, the lyrics, again, were just so important. I mean, just, like, I can understand some people not liking the Smiths' music, but, like, I just find you someone who seeks such importance in the lyrics.
I'm soaked in that generation of alternative music, so obviously, actually, deep down, I do like the Smiths.
Right.
Or they, you know, they might not have influenced me, but they've definitely influenced people that then went on to be key influences in my music life.
And so who was your big band when you were growing up then?
Probably Carter, who I know you love.
Yeah.
And I've sort of been really lucky enough to go on to become friends with Jim and Les, and they're an amazing band now. And they're actually doing their last ever show.
Yeah, I went to... Well, yeah, they say that every year.
Yeah, they say every time.
So let's not have that. But I went to their last ever show at Brixton, and I thought it was going to be, as you said, like, you know, just, oh, yeah, it'd be great to have a little reminisce. But it was just... powerful,
yeah, like almost better than they ever were.
Yeah,
they're just yeah, which
especially
is,
with the climate, you know, where there's so much mush out there. It feels
I think the same about
again.
Tom Robinson. We just did some shows with Tom Robinson, and you know, he's playing his Power in the Darkness album from the late 70s in full, like doing one of those full album shows.
Sure.
And you think, and I think this is going to be great fun as a sort of nostalgia, but also sort of rekindling of political stuff.
Yeah,
but actually, they just rocked like bastards. They were brilliant. Amazing. So, and it was, yeah, it was so exciting.
So listen, you'll do another track for us. Which one?
Yeah, I'll do a quiet one, if that's all right. I'll do Gulls.
I don't think
maybe.
So. Also, Left-Hander, respect.
Yes, yeah, which means you can have the guitar if you want and do some playing.
I have no skills when it comes to things like that. So this one's called what,
this
Chris?
Is called Gulls.
Gulls, as in?
The seagulls, yeah.
Lovely.
Like what they're called, herring gulls, yeah.
Lovely stuff.
And it's a true story.
Well, I'm sure it's self-explanatory then, yeah?
It is.
All right, cheers.
That day I found a dolphin washed up on the shore. I think I was the first to see it. Early morning walk. So I made a phone call. I guess it was thrown out by a trawler. And I knew what they'd say. Can you stay nearby? Stand beside the dolphin until we can come take it away. So I stood for half an hour. With the bloody upturned hull, ooh, ooh, ooh. A shipwrecked companion, ooh, ooh, ooh. He's eaten by the gulls, ooh, ooh, ooh. He's eaten by the gulls, the gulls, the gulls are hungry. Ripping through the bin bags down the street, tearing at our insides, tearing at our private lives, spreading them around for all to see. That day I hadn't seen her. Not even online. Something in the air, and I'm already scared. Even before her dad shows up at mine. So I stood for half an hour. Bloody upturned shell. Ooh, 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 ooh. I was your shipwreck companion. Ooh, 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 ooh. But now I'm drowning in the swell. get up after that. You don't 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 get up after that.
I could tell that was the ending. Classic ending there. Quiet one, Chris. Quiet one.
Sorry.
No, I loved it. But listen, thank you so much for coming in. And,
no, it's a total pleasure.
The only compliment I can say is it strikes me as very English music, which I love.
Well, thank you.
Reminds me, in the same lesson as why I love Julian Cope. You know, it's just that proper English sentiment.
Oh, really? I mean, that's a lovely thing to say. Thank you.
But listen,
much.
And so where can, people, see you? Or,
I tour with my backing band, the Hood Rats, and we'll be touring before summer and then after summer, and loads of festivals, hopefully.
Well, look, we'll get you in again, and I'll have words with management. We'll get one of your songs on the playlist.
That'd be great, yeah, do it.
I'm not promising it, but you know, yeah.
Listeners, shout at them, tell them to playlist me, then I get more airtime. That's fantastic.
And what I'm doing now, crazily, finishing the show. Thanks to all the guests today, Mike and Phil and Ben and Sean as well. I'm Sean Hughes, FUBAR, and
FUBAR, giving radio the finger.